Prepare to be astonished!
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and welcome to an adventure in history. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital here this evening with Mac Burns, Clatsop County Historical Director.
It's just you and me.
I know. How's it going?
It's going well.
Good. It's going well.
I was going to keep talking there, but then I thought, no. And then I was torn with, do I want to plug the exhibit again?
It's a fabulous exhibit, Away From Home, here through May.
May 25th.
Okay.
So it might be a recurring thing.
Okay, yeah. And you can
learn. Because it's a really good exhibit.
It is. And this is the closest it's going to get. Even I remember this.
That's right.
The nearest it's going to be next will be Boise, Idaho. Also a nice place to visit, but just a little ways away.
Idaho is wonderful, but you'd have to wait till next year.
Right.
So this is the time and place.
It's great.
So Away From Home, Native American Indian Boarding School Stories, the National Endowment for the Humanities. We're playing with the big boys.
Yes. Good. Bringing to small communities across America.
Although looking at some of the organizations that are hosting this, because it's already booked 5 years out, it's kind of funny. There's a few that are smaller than our organization, and then there's a lot that are bigger, and then there's a lot that are kind of just like us, that are rural historical societies or rural museums, and that's part of the whole program, is to get this exhibit out there where America can see it.
Oh, I think that's great. I mean, access is everything, right?
Yes.
Well, good.
So, should we hit the history highlights? These are things tomorrow.
Yes.
That you can appear
tomorrow
smart.
In history.
1824, Lord Byron dies in Greece. I didn't realize he was in Greece. Okay, 1876, because you know I like the Western stuff. Wyatt Earp is dropped from the Wichita Police Force. The commission votes not to rehire him after he beats up a candidate for county sheriff.
I like that.
You know why we love Wyatt Earp and why history loves him?
Why?
Because he lived for a long time, so he controlled his story.
And he had a great name, too, right? I mean, that was just easy to remember. It's not normal.
It is a good name.
Yeah.
Wyatt Earp and the Earp brothers.
There you go.
There were a lot of Earps. And, of course, you know, I was in the movie Wyatt Earp.
Oh, I did not know that.
With Kevin Costner.
Oh.
I'm on screen for 11 seconds.
Oh, cool.
11 glorious seconds. But you have to get the widescreen version because it's a panoramic and I'm on the far left. So when it's, you know, this has been made to fit on your TV screen, they cut off the left
You're
and the right sides.
And
I'm not in it anymore. I was outraged
That's
when I saw
too
that.
Funny.
So I had to get the widescreen version.
Or buy the widescreen TV too.
Yes.
Right?
That could be. That would have been the more expensive.
Yes.
Option. Way to do that. Okay, 1897, the first Boston Marathon is held.
Oh, okay, 1897.
Now, are you a runner or do you just plan giant runs?
I just planned giant runs, yes. No.
You used to plan when you were at the Chamber.
I did, and yeah, Great Columbia Crossing, and yep.
Were yours the most attended ever?
Actually, yes, they were.
I kind of thought it might be.
We limited capacity. Regina and I did. We worked on that together and maxed the capacity because we found sort of that perfect number. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I believe it was 3,000. And it may have gone down even since then because you want it to be a nice experience, right?
Yes.
It's a long bridge.
I did it once.
You did? I was there when you were doing it.
I was very nervous. I was going to get scooped up by the bus that picks up the people that don't get off the bridge by 2 hours.
I've heard it's a fun bus.
See, I've heard that too, but I didn't. I wanted to finish, so I did.
Good. Good job.
In an hour and 40 minutes or an hour and 35 or something like that.
I've done it once.
Did you?
Because when I worked there, of course, I couldn't do it.
Yes.
And so afterwards, yes, I did it. It was beautiful, very cold, sunny day.
Did you run or walk?
I walked.
Okay. See, I don't know if you're a runner or not.
Nope.
Okay.
I can run.
I could run if a bear is chasing me.
I have two small children. I run all the time. I'm chasing them.
That's true. But I was going to say, but that's like a zigzag race.
Yes.
It's not a straight race.
I get a lot of steps every day.
So on this day, 1897, the first Boston Marathon. 1939, Connecticut finally approves the Bill of Rights 148 years later. What's the deal, Connecticut?
And they seem so modern, don't they?
I was caught off guard by that. So this is our message for Connecticut. What's the deal?
Yeah.
All right. We're picking on Connecticut today. 1943, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising begins.
Ooh.
You know, I was at last week, we mentioned, so 2 weeks in a row, I'm mentioning the Holocaust Museum. There's an incredible, really just heart-wrenching segment on the Warsaw Ghetto at the the museum, Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And it really is just amazing. I mean, anyway.
Very touching.
Yeah. 1982, Sally Ride is named the first American woman astronaut.
I like that one.
And I love her name. Mm-hmm. Sally Ride, I'm going to take a ride on the shuttle. I mean, that's so that's hilarious. Good. But I'm offended at 1982.
Yes, I know.
Come on, NASA. Why can't women go into space? You look at all the science fiction shows.
Right.
I mean, there's always women out there in space. Why did it take 82 before we realized? Oh, half the population we're not letting go up. All right. 1995, not a good one. Oklahoma City bombing. Mm. What's wrong with people?
I don't know.
But our history highlight of the day, the thing I think had the most impact on history, 1775. The American Revolution begins at the Battle of Lexington.
Yes.
700 British troops. And these are trained, the cream of the world, the most vicious professional fighting force in the world. 700 British troops versus 77 armed Minutemen under Captain John Parker. You know, I don't know if it's completely true, so I might be giving a mistruth, but I remember one of my history professors talking about when we declared war, when we declared our independence, we had exactly two cannon. Mm. In our Continental Army.
Wow.
And we declare war on the largest empire in the world with two cannon.
That's it. Wow. Well, those who win get to write the history.
But important side note, we didn't win. We just didn't lose.
That's good.
See, I do always, I was in a summer camp once and we had some guys from Britain and the very younger counselors that were American and were like, we kicked your butt in the American Revolution. And I always had to kind of correct that we didn't. We won a couple of very key battles, but the key thing was Washington never just got totally decimated and kept our troops still alive. So,
and that's why we're all at this camp today together. The couple you missed,
I missed
1934,
some.
Shirley Temple appears in her first movie.
Ooh.
Gotta love that. And then 1960, I'm surprised you missed.
Wait, what movie? I don't know that I would guess this.
I don't know what her first movie was.
All right.
But she had to have been really young and she's super cute.
I was going to start singing Lollipop, but that's probably not her first movie. Nope. So,
1960, baseball uniforms begin displaying players' names on their backs.
Oh, I like that because I don't know the numbers.
Right.
I know a few of them, but I want to know who that guy is.
And then the last was 1977. Alex Haley receives a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Roots.
Roots, ooh.
Yeah, 1977.
Which I wonder if that's still the highest rated miniseries or not.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know. Okay, so somewhat topical,
yes,
which is why we're going to talk about this, but not necessarily specific to Clatsop County. Immigration has been in the news a lot.
Yep.
So I don't know when I stumbled across this, but a little bit about Ellis Island. And I've never visited Ellis Island, even though I lived in the region for a while. So I'm kind of sad.
Yeah.
I've seen it in movies.
And I haven't been there, no.
So we're going to talk a little bit about immigration. The Ellis Island immigration process was not easy for those who traveled to the United States. Immigrants often spent several days or weeks at sea before getting to the island and were exhausted and hungry when they arrived. And countless people went through this grueling ritual. The first immigrant passed through Ellis Island on January 1st, 1892, and foreigners continued to be processed there through the 1930s.
Now, the Ellis Island inspection process took several hours and did not guarantee that an individual or their family would pass. Immigrants endured medical inspections and hours of legal questioning before they were allowed to step on American soil. Many were detained just because they were sick. In fact, on July 19, 1884, then-President Chester Arthur issued a proclamation allowing the government to quarantine people entering the United States to prevent the spread of pestilence due to mounting concerns over tuberculosis. Other times, immigrants were detained because they didn't have immediate family members to meet them or they didn't have the financial means to settle in the United States. Only a very small percentage were deported due to health problems or other issues. Immigration through Ellis Island may have been a challenge for many, but it was their chance to make a new life for themselves. For scores of determined immigrants, the brutal questions and inspections were merely the price of admission to America. Now, when immigrants arrived at Ellis Island, they were funneled through a line in the Great Hall. In addition to medical exams, they spent several hours answering questions. They were asked 29 questions with the help of an interpreter, including these.
Are you meeting a relative here in America? Who? I was going to actually make you, like, answer these.
Oh, jeez.
Have you been in a prison? almshouse or institution for care of the insane? Are you a polygamist? Are you an anarchist? I like that those two are linked together.
Right.
Are you coming to America for a job? Where will you work? Are you deformed or crippled? Don't you think they would be able just to look and see?
Ugh.
It seems odd to actually ask that question. Who was the first president of America? I would be annoying because I would say, well, under the Constitution or after the Constitution? Do you want George Washington? I assume you want George Washington. What is the Constitution? Which president freed the slaves? Can you name the 13 original colonies? Who is the current president of the United States?
Now, people that were deaf were often rejected because they were considered financial burdens. A deaf Jewish girl named Nellie Ratner left Vienna, Austria in 1938 after the Nazis rose to power. She, her mother Hilda, and her sister, also deaf, traveled to the United States from Italy, hoping for a better life. However, they wound up spending 5 months living on Ellis Island because immigration officials feared they will be financially dependent on the government. A woman named Tanya Nash, who worked for the New York Society of the Deaf, advocated for the family, telling a judge that deaf people could be very independent. Initially, her efforts didn't work. However, the family ended up receiving a $2,500 bond from Jewish philanthropists, as Ratner later recalled.
This is money to support us if we couldn't work or something. So then later they did and finally let us go. We were so happy to leave. When we got out, my mother and uncle worked, saved, paid back the money. It took 5 years. The money was all paid off finally, $2,500 in 5 years. They both worked so hard.
Ratner's uncle found them a place to live in the Bronx, and they later moved to Brooklyn and then Manhattan. But they fought over beds and struggled with language barriers. Gabriel Tarino left Spain and arrived at Ellis Island in August 1920. He likened his stay on Ellis Island to being in prison. He wrote in his diary that he was very lonely after being separated from his wife, daughter, and son.
Why is this? Staying with people that I don't understand, and they don't understand me. If I get a fever, who is going to care for me? I do not know. Therefore, a deep sadness envelops me, and wonder where it's going to stop. If I could only speak with these guards, but when I try, they dispel me, and almost use their hands on me.
He also noted that people would fight over the cots.
In the dormitories, there are so many fights for the sleeping cots that we tremble with fear, because if two persons get to the cot at the same time, one says, "This is mine," and the other one, "No, it's mine," until they start beating each other. In the salons, the same thing happens. I was sitting on a bench one day, and two of these morons, and they took it off of me, and two Spaniards, when they saw what was happening, they came to my assistance. I saw that the others were going to hit them, so I told the Spaniards, "Forget it, let them have it," because anyone could lose their life or be maimed by such animals without a conscience.
Torino added that the dining halls were very loud and people were rude. It was difficult communicating with immigrants from all over the world, including France, Italy, Peru, and Japan.
They cause such a ruckus that even God cannot understand.
I-men singled out immigrants who had dangerous disease.
I like that they call them the I-men.
The I-men.
Like they're keeping their eye on everybody.
Yeah. Took me off. Doctors known as I-men examined immigrants for trachoma, which not only caused blindness, it could kill. Around 50% of the people who were detained on Ellis Island had this disease, and they were usually deported. Josephine Gazzieri was 15 when she traveled from Italy to the United States with her father and brother. She had trachoma. Since it was highly contagious, she was quarantined in the medical wing until deportation. When her father found out he needed a $1,000 bond for her treatment or else she would be deported, he took action, asking strangers for a loan. Fortunately, he was able to raise enough money to pay for her treatment. Gazzieri was placed in a special section of the hospital for people who had trachoma and spent 11 and a half months there, as she later recalled.
They just take you there and take your clothes off and give you clothes that belong to the hospital. So you have identification. You can't run away. So nobody tried to run away. We got nowhere to go. We had a guard with a gun in the front of the building and in the back of the building. So we made no attempts of running away.
She received daily treatments and was not allowed to walk because that would have created too much heat on her eyelids and stall the healing process. They were marked with these medical conditions. A boy named Willem was 16 years old when he traveled to the United States from Germany in 1910. He struggled on the trip, battling seasickness and vomiting for days. He remembered entering Ellis Island and lining up for a medical exam. People were marked on their lapels with chalk, indicating whether or not they were fit to enter America. Immigrants without any mental problems were marked with an X on their right shoulder. A circle with an X meant there was a problem. A B indicated back problems. PG equaled pregnancy. SC meant there was a scalp infection, and so on. Those who had issues received additional exams in another room. We've always been very good at labeling people, haven't we?
I was going to say, it's just
how dehumanizing.
It's just amazing that it's that easy and that there's all these initials and everybody would know what they stood for.
Right. And you have all these languages. I mean, yeah. Even those whole questions, too. I mean, some of those words, they had to have been lost in translation, too.
The whole idea of Ellis Island just amazes me with the different languages and the how do you...
And are you really controlling disease? Because, dude, the people that work there never leave?
Yeah.
I mean, how's that work? You have to... You're putting them all together. Well, Willem explained the scene.
So they led us through a big hall, and we had to strip naked in a small room. And we met two fellas. You know, you never want to meet fellas when you're naked. They were doctors with stethoscopes. I didn't know what a stethoscope was. I learned that after. They tapped us on the chest and on the back, and then I had to run around. I was the only one they examined that way. All of a sudden, one doctor yelled and raised his fist. He was going to knock the other fellow down, the other doctor. I didn't know what it meant. I was told afterward. One said I had consumption, and the other doctor said there was nothing wrong with me. All I needed was a belly full of food for a couple of months. I was undernourished.
Willem eventually passed and was met by his cousin, who took him to Brooklyn to live with their relatives. Approximately 20% of immigrants were held for medical treatment or for legal hearing. Only 2% were denied entry. Parents did have to make some unbearable decisions if their children were deported. So if an immigrant child was age 12 or older and didn't pass the medical exam, he or she was deported alone. If a child was under the age of 12 and had a chronic or contagious disease, he or she was also deported but had to be accompanied by one parent. Now you can imagine the struggle families faced while they were deciding who would accompany their ill child back to Europe. Let's say a single mother arrived with three children and one of them under the age of 12 had a contagious disease. She would either have to take the whole family back to their homeland or leave her two healthy children with relatives already established in America.
Pick a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what parent can make
and
that choice?
And it seems a little subjective by that two doctors in a room.
arguing.
Diagnosis. they were given just 10 minutes of fresh air. Isabel Berlosky's life in Leningrad, Russia was difficult. Her family lived in an apartment with five other families with just one bathroom between them. It was extremely hard for most people to leave the country, but her father was an opera singer who secured a visa that enabled them to go to the United States. In 1930, they traveled from Leningrad to Poland and Germany before getting on a ship in France. When the family arrived in New York, a relative who was supposed to meet them with the $500 bond didn't show up. Berlosky recalled the tough time they spent waiting.
We spent the night at Ellis Island. I should try and do accents, but I probably shouldn't.
You probably shouldn't.
So I shouldn't. We spent the night at Ellis Island, where there were 40 cots in each room, but no sheets. We were fed a bowl of soup and allowed 10 minutes of fresh air. They counted us every time we entered or left a room.
They were finally given permission to enter America after passing a medical exam and appearing before a judge. Sick children were quarantined away from their family. In 1920, 8-year-old Seymour Reichert traveled from Poland with his father to the United States. They planned on making some money in America before sending for the rest of the family. He recalled how he was separated from his father when they arrived on Ellis Island because he had a cold.
At Ellis Island, my father, who was not sick, stood in long lines as part of the entry process. Officials asked him lots of questions about where he came from, what he did for a living back in Poland, and what his plans were in America. All immigrants had to answer these questions. Only then could the newcomers leave Ellis Island and take a ferry to New York and finally set foot in America. When the doctor examined me, he discovered I had a cold. He said I could not go with my father, though I cried and begged. I was terrified to be all alone in this strange place. I stayed on Ellis Island for a few days until I was feeling better. I had no toys with me. I didn't know of such things, but there were other sick boys to keep me company. Some of them spoke Yiddish, my language. We ate in a huge dining room. The food was different. It was American style, but it was good, especially the milk.
There was a long gate that led to the boats that took people off the island across New York Harbor to the city. And every day, those boys would walk to the gate and look out over the water. They wanted to see America because it was like being in jail. They said, we felt sad and wondered if we would ever get through that gate and onto a boat for that final journey to our new country, the United States. When Wright recovered, he and his father were able to leave Ellis Island. The first American immigrants met was an interpreter. Immigrants arrived at Ellis Island from various countries, including Germany, Ireland, Poland, Hungary, Greece, and Turkey. As you can imagine, they encountered people speaking many different languages when they stepped onto the island for the first time. The first American they met was usually an interpreter who helped guide them through the process of immigration.
These interpreters were invaluable because they often helped immigrants get into America. Without their help, many immigrants would have been turned away and deported. The average interpreter spoke six languages. And I had trouble with college Spanish and high school Spanish. However, some spoke as many as 12. One individual spoke 15 languages. Children sometimes arrived alone.
Children arrived on Ellis Island either with their parents or alone. Some were orphans and received sponsorships from charities and other groups. Employees who worked at Ellis Island tried to make the place welcoming for children, some of whom spent weeks or months in limbo while they were waiting for entry into America. Around 1900, officials built a playground to entertain the kids. The island also employed matrons who would play games with and sing songs to the children, even though many of them didn't speak the same language. The Red Cross donated a radio for the kids, and eventually a classroom was installed.
They ate three meals a day and had a library for entertainment. A Yugoslavian man named Paul Frikovic left his communist country for the United States in 1946. He legally entered the country via Mexico, but eventually received a letter from immigration officials asking him to travel to New York City for voluntary deportation. Frankovich spent nearly 4 months at Ellis Island waiting. After World War II, Ellis Island was mainly used for detention and deportation.
Life at Ellis Island was pretty good, according to him. He had three meals a day, a clean bed, and access to a library full of books. He recalled,
"If former Yugoslavia was like Ellis Island, I think everybody would come to Ellis Island."
He eventually got his green card and became a naturalized citizen. They were entranced, right, by the Statue of Liberty. Sadie Brown was 13 years old when she and her mother left Poland to move to the United States. Her father had died, and her aunt Fanny in New York City planned on helping them when they arrived in America. Brown told her story to a journalist when she was 16.
"We came by steerage on a steamship in a very dark place that smelled dreadfully. There were hundreds of other people packed in with us, men, women, and children, and almost all of them were sick. It took us 12 days to cross the sea, and we thought we should die. But at last the voyage was over, and we came up and saw the beautiful bay and the big woman with the spikes on her head and the lamp that is lighted at night in her hand."
In other first-hand accounts of arriving at Ellis Island, a 79-year-old German man said of seeing the statue,
"I thought she was the one of seven wonders of the world."
And a man from Poland gushed,
"The bigness of Mrs. Liberty overcame us. No one spoke a word, for she was like a goddess, and we know she represented the big, powerful country which was to be our future home."
I think different perspectives, too, from people that had to wait, maybe,
yeah.
before going...
I'm amazed. I mean, can you picture like packing up everything into a suitcase with your family and just going to this unknown place?
Right. And how distraught your situation must be to make that decision.
Yeah. We truly are fortunate where we live.
Yes, we are.
Shall we take a little break?
That sounds good. We'll be right back.
April 7th, 1910. Fresh vegetables, new stock spring, asparagus, cauliflower, rhubarb, peas, sweet potatoes, artichokes, etc. Johnson & Morrison, 606-608 Commercial Street. If you don't trade with us, we both lose money.
April 6th, 1907. Curtain and blanket cleaning. If you want your curtains and blankets cleaned right, send them to Mrs. Rasmussen or leave orders at the Oregon Bakery.
And welcome back to An Adventure in History. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Eastside Hospital here this evening with Mac Burns from the Clatsop County Historical Society.
So one more quick plug for the Away From Home traveling exhibit about Native American boarding schools, speaking about people leaving their home.
Yes.
These ones not voluntarily.
Sure. So,
and, you know, one of the things we didn't talk about last week with Chelsea a little bit, but they were forced to let these kids go. Mm-hmm. It wasn't parents trying to decide, well, like, should I let my kid go to college or not? I mean, there was no choice. And sometimes if they refused, other pressures would be put on them. Like suddenly the reservation might have less food available. And all of a sudden you're having to be that choice of, well, my kid is starving, but at least at the boarding school, maybe they'll be fed.
Right.
So even if they weren't just overtly the guy showing up saying, here to pick up your kids, there were other ways that they were forced to have their kids go.
And then the purpose is total assimilation and totally erasing that culture and history. Yeah, tough.
So shall we do a little bit of this week in local history?
Yes, let's do some.
So April 18th, 1910, on Saturday evening, a man named W. Dell was arrested by Chief Oberg on a charge of stealing copper wire from the Astoria Electric Company. During several previous nights, someone had been cutting off pieces of the main return wire of the streetcar system. Dell was caught trying to dispose of a sack of the stolen property. He, of course, denied his guilt and claimed he found the wire already sacked and lying on the beach.
Of course he did.
One me.
April 19th, 1917, a committee of patriotic citizens from Clatsop Plains met in Astoria Mayor Harley's office preparing the program for the forthcoming State Grange Convention. The farmer members of the party offered to donate land for planting vegetables this spring to city folk who were enthusiastic in the movement to increase the food supply. It's pretty nice of them.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like this one too. April 21st, 1896. Strawberries are beginning to come in larger quantities, and prices are getting down to an average man's pocketbook. A few baby flies are walking on the window panes, and people feel that spring is here, even though their teeth chatter when arising in the morning.
That sounds like spring in Clatsop County.
It does. But just, oh, you got the strawberries, you got flies, you got chattering, yeah. You got spring. They're all over the place.
They got to write so much better back then. April 22nd, 1912, two of the largest salmon packing plants on the Columbia River with several branches along the Pacific coast and in Alaska have recently installed sanitary can-making machinery, which enables them to manufacture their own cans besides furnishing the market demands along the river. No canneries.
No canneries.
Left now along the Columbia River, on our side at least.
No.
Canneries. We have processing plants, though.
Processing plants.
Of course.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. We still call them canneries.
I was going to say, what's the official difference? Is it whether you're putting it in a can or not?
Correct.
Or what?
Yeah. A cannery is a cannery. So
okay.
Yes, it is. Does go. And that is what existed. I mean, they were processing plants that had canneries.
Was skipping on a canning or a processor?
It was both.
Okay.
It was both. Yep. But one of the last. So Bell Buoy in Seaside's. Not
wow.
the last locally.
Because you come from a long line of canners.
Yes, we do. My husband's side.
Were you married into it?
I'm married into it.
Okay. So again, the wonderful exhibit here at the Heritage Museum. And everybody should come. It's got another month. May 25th is when it's over. Traveling exhibit. Very powerful. It's if you want like a punch in the gut every 5 minutes as you go through this exhibit, because you're just going to all of a sudden see another story and just go,
yeah. Very powerful.
Or to quote my wife, what's wrong with people? When she went through, she kept saying that.
Yeah. So. Well, it's good to remember that.
All right.
Go make some history.
We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.